This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. The debate over fossil fuels is intense, even more so in the towns whose economies depend on oil and gas. Towns like Greeley, Colorado, an hour north of Denver, booming with new homes and new drills, sometimes side by side. We were there a few weeks ago to hear from its residents about oil and gas. For example, you've heard the environmental argument against drilling, but have you ever heard the argument for it? We did, while visiting drilling sites run by SRC Energy. We went to a site preparing a well for hydraulic fracturing, also known as fracking. If you're thinking of a gushing oil well, this is not that. Far from it. It's much more precise, and what we heard when we visited was not that noisy, at least not after the initial drilling is done. Folks at SRC said their environmental safeguards have evolved a lot over the decades. Brian Koshier, a drilling engineer manager, also said that he takes pride in providing fuel to power the nation.
If you think about what the industry does for society, it supports the way of life that we're all used to. So it's an incredibly gratifying industry to work in, because we understand what we're providing for society, essentially. So it's just fascinating, always changing.
Greeley is full of people who work in energy, who also take pride in that work. They live side by side with folks who don't like having drills and wells a few hundred yards from their homes, farms, and schools. And both groups showed up to our event at the University of Northern Colorado in Greeley. A resident named Mike was among those who spoke up.
I'm a physician in Fort Collins. I'm told that there are over 55,000 oil and gas wells in Northern Colorado. I'm concerned about our health, our water, our air. I believe people are sicker because of it. I believe children are sicker. I believe newborns are being affected.
We'll bring you more highlights from that event just ahead. But first, let's get a sense of how the oil and gas business is doing nationally. Joining us in studio is Amy Harder, who covers energy and climate for Axios. Amy, welcome back to 1A.
Thank you for having me on.
We only have Amy for this first segment, so we welcome your questions and thoughts about oil and gas nationwide, including if you work in the industry. Email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Amy, you've reported from Colorado, so you know Greeley. Give us a sense of how important this community, this state, is to oil and gas nationwide.
Colorado really is ground zero for not just America's boom in oil and natural gas, but the conflicts that it brings. So I've spent a lot of time in Greeley and Fort Collins and Denver talking with all sides of this debate. And the reason why Colorado is ground zero is because what's happening here is the oil and gas companies are encroaching. Or actually, it's the other way around. The population is growing where the oil and gas has always been. And so you have this collision. And you don't have that in states like Texas and Oklahoma. And another reason why it's so important is that Colorado is an important political state. The former governor, Governor Hickenlooper, is a Democratic candidate for president. So that's another reason why I and a lot of other reporters have focused on it.
It's interesting, as we drove from Denver International Airport to Greeley, you see there are all these housing developments, brand new housing developments all the way from the airport to Greeley. And then in between them, kind of dotted in between them, are these big tanks where oil and natural gas are being extracted. So you really can't separate one from the other.
No, you can't. And the law really is on the side of the oil and gas companies. It's their right under the law to drill where they're drilling. And these neighborhoods have encroached onto that land. And so the question becomes, should it be that way? Should the law change? And I know Colorado is debating that issue right now.
You'll hear part of that debate in just a little bit. But give us a sense of where oil and natural gas stands in the U.S. overall right now. There is a push to go toward more renewables, get away from fossil fuels. But where does that stand?
America has become the world's biggest producer of both oil and natural gas over the last several years. So while there is increasing talk about the urgency of climate change and the growth of renewables, the big picture is that America is doing better than ever when it comes to production of oil and natural gas. Of course, a lot of challenges come with that, the local resistance, as you'll see in Colorado, and then broader impacts such as climate change. But from a basic perspective of production, as President Trump has said, America is really leading the world.
There's also this debate over the shifting balance of how we get our energy. Martin emailed, if we're going to eliminate coal as a source of energy, we will have to rely on natural gas as the least dirty fossil fuel until nuclear and renewable energy can fill the void. Where does that balance stand right now in terms of where America gets its power?
Well, natural gas is now the dominant, the largest source of electricity here in America. That has been a flip over the last decade when coal was the dominant. There is a raging debate in Colorado and around the country, and in fact, even the world, about the role that natural gas should play. But I think while that debate is happening, the shift is happening to natural gas, and companies and countries are doubling down on this fuel. So, and I do agree with the listener that natural gas is a lot cleaner than coal, and for many countries and cities and states, it is going to be a cheap option.
There's also a difference in the way that you extract natural gas versus oil. Granted, some of the wells that we visited, they get some oil, some natural gas, they get an array of different things, but the technology in terms of how fracking is done has come a long way. SRC Energy, the company that showed us around, spoke at length about how, you know, they're much more precise with knowing where pockets of natural gas are, how to drill to them more directly. You know, the way we do it seems to have come quite a ways.
Correct. And companies are able to get a lot more oil and gas from one well pad than they've ever been before. And that's due to technologies like horizontal drilling that allows you to go down vertical to a certain extent and then go horizontal. And so that minimizes the impact on neighborhoods. But there's just no good way to drill in a backyard. It's as if somebody was poking you in the eye. Well, you could poke them softly, but you still don't want to be poked in the eye.
There's also the issue in terms of land rights. You know, a lot of what we heard early on in our trip had to do with who owns, you know, the land at the surface that we walk on, and then the land under the surface, sometimes miles under the surface, where these oil and natural gas deposits are. And from what we heard in Colorado, that's a big part of the debate. How much is that a part of the debate nationally? Is that kind of a Colorado thing?
It's definitely a national issue, but the laws differ by state. So it really depends on how state law is. I know in Colorado, the state owns most of the minerals. So, you know, I think it's a lot easier to stomach having the noise impacts and the truck impacts and the potential health impacts if you're getting a pot of money for letting companies drill on your land. And so I think that's a very important question, but it really is dependent upon the state.
We're speaking to Amy Harder, who covers energy and climate for Axios. We'd love to get your questions and thoughts in as well. Before we bring you highlights from our event in Greeley, 1A at WAMU.org. Some of what we will hear later on from those excerpts is how the climate in Colorado is cleaner than it used to be and that the industry is polluting less. The folks that we spoke to were very proud of the fact that the standards for keeping the environment around these drilling sites clean has come a long way over the last few decades. But can you put that in context? Is the air clean or is it just cleaner?
Well, the air is certainly cleaner than it was, you know, in 1970, but that's because the Environmental Protection Agency was founded and the Clean Air Act amendments were passed that were incredibly aggressive in clamping down on air pollution. And so the federal government has been incredibly successful in getting companies that pollute, such as oil and gas companies, to be cleaner. You know, industry always says that voluntary action is sufficient, but in most cases, I would argue that it's not sufficient and that you do need regulation.
The industry does, at least SRC Energy, talked about how they will go from well to well and kind of look for leaks proactively. There's a certain amount of time they have to plug those leaks. Where does that stand right now in terms of energy companies having to be proactive across the country about being as clean as possible?
Well, right now, with the Trump administration rolling back a lot of regulations, you're actually ironically seeing oil and gas companies stepping up and saying that we will do these things regardless. Methane emissions is a hot topic in Colorado and, in fact, around the world. Methane is the primary component of natural gas. It's also a potent greenhouse gas. And so Colorado actually has what some would argue is the most aggressive regulation on methane that was struck by Governor Hickenlooper and oil and gas companies in Colorado. So they can say that they're doing this proactively, but they also struck a deal with the government. And so it's often, it's not just the government or just the companies, it's this collaboration. And I think that's what you saw in Colorado.
Let me get to one more comment from Texas. Anthony emailed, I am a native Houstonian. And as I write this, two of our neighborhoods in East Houston are under a shelter inside warning because of a chemical fire at one of our many plants. Oil and gas is old and dirty. And in 2019, we should be investing in new forms of energy and not recycling those of the last century. We've been seeing the images of that gigantic fire at that oil storage facility. You know, how far have we come in terms of being able to get away from these kinds of potentially more dangerous forms of energy, particularly because for folks like Anthony, just optically, it's kind of terrifying.
Correct. And when terrible things like that happen, it's a reminder that our everyday lives are dependent upon quite dangerous sources of energy. And that's something that we don't think about until something bad happens. I would say that the track record of the oil and gas industry is very, very good. But when something bad happens, it's very bad. There was an explosion, natural gas explosion in Firestone, Colorado, that killed people. So it's minimizing those risks to zero, if possible.
Amy Harder covers energy and climate for Axios. Amy, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
That Firestone incident was something that Coloradans brought up, including at our event in Greeley. You will hear edited highlights of that as part of our partnership with KUNC Public Radio in just a moment. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. Folks in Colorado have a lot to say about oil and natural gas. It's a billion-dollar industry that feeds many families and leaves many other families very concerned. We explored it as part of our project 1A Across America, a partnership with six member stations, including KUNC in northern Colorado. Across America helps us keep in tune with the big issues people are talking about in their neighborhoods, issues that can get ignored in big election years. We met two people in Greeley, Colorado, with different views of the energy industry. Erica Deacon lives in Erie and runs her communications business out of her home. Roy Ramirez took over his father's maintenance services business in Platteville.
So the ones that were behind our house that were so offensive were roughly between the two of them combined. There were about 13 drills. It's like a dull roar, like a low, like that. You know, I've spent entire seasons not being able to sit outside my house because it smells too bad and it's too loud. That's crazy if you think about it.
There's a lot of us, like myself, that basically grew up in this industry. It's what I know. I don't tell them how to make their money. My father came here in the early 60s as an immigrant from Mexico. And this is the dream he had, is for some of us, some of his kids to, you know, have the American dream. And I'm realizing it. We're trying to have it, but there's rocks in the road, and all I want to do is provide for my family and the 47 families that work for me. That's it.
Those were Erica Deacon of Erie and Roy Ramirez of Platteville. Now let's get to some edited highlights from our town hall event in Greeley, a conversation on the future of oil and gas exploration in Colorado. You'll find the whole event online at the1a.org. And we'll begin with a few introductions. To my right, your left, is Casey Becker, the Speaker of the Colorado House of Representatives. Her solidly Democratic district includes parts of Boulder County and all of Clear Creek, Gilpin, Grand, and Jackson counties. She recently introduced a bill to remake much of the state's oil and gas industry. Speaker Becker, welcome to 1A.
Thank you for having me, Joshua.
Also with us is Chris Wright, the Chairman and CEO of Liberty Oil Field Services, which is a Denver-based company. Chris, welcome.
Thanks. Glad to be here, Joshua.
Next to Chris, is Therese Gilbert, a co-founder of Weld Air and Water, which is a grassroots community organization that promotes health and safety around oil development. And she also teaches middle school here in Greeley. Therese, welcome.
Thank you.
And also with us is KUNC's Matt Bloom, who covers energy and the economy. Matt, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
Matt, I'm going to start with you. For the benefit of our listeners who are not familiar with Colorado, give us a sense of the scope of oil and gas in this state and the growth of it. From what I understand, it was already big in recent years, and it has grown much bigger in a very short period of time.
Absolutely. I mean, living here in Weld County, you can't go to the grocery store without seeing a tank, without seeing a tower. And I think that if you live north of Denver, if you live in the Northern Front Range, it's a part of your life. Everywhere you go, you're seeing it. You're asking questions to yourself. It might be in your backyard. I mean, this is an industry that whether you work in it or not, you are passing it on the daily throughout your day-to-day life.
Chris Wright, let me come to you. A lot of what gets discussed in conversations about oil and gas has to do with hydraulic fracturing, sometimes known as fracking. Can you just explain, just for the benefit of people who don't work in the industry, what exactly that is and how it works?
You bet. I'll try to be quick. But oil and gas is formed by small organisms that live in the oceans. Where we sit right now was an inland sea. And the world was much warmer, much more CO2 in the air, and this was a jungle. So huge amount of life, huge amount of life in the ocean. As those things fall down, as they die, these single-cell organisms that fall down to the bottom of the ocean, if they get buried just in the right kind of rocks, which are rocks with very little permeability, it's like a kitchen counter rock, then they'll get preserved. The old oil and gas industry was waiting for it to naturally leak out of those. That's oil and gas until 10 years ago. Now we're going into these like kitchen counter rocks, drilling holes and pumping water to create a series, a whole bunch of cracks in this rock. Because you can imagine oil, if you put it on top of your kitchen counter, it would evaporate before it would flow through. So it doesn't move very easily, but there's an enormous amount on the rock. So to get it out, you've got to cut with water all sorts of basically layers of slice, 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 slice. And so hydraulic fracturing is what's doubled U.S. oil production in the last 7 or 8 years.
So basically you're breaking holes into the earth to allow those particles of oil, gas, and hydrocarbons to reach you more readily than they would if they just kind of seeped through time and the normal like action of the earth.
Yes.
Speaker Becker, you introduced an energy package on Friday. It's kind of the core of our conversation this evening, and it's been described as some of the most sweeping changes, at least, to oil and gas in Colorado in quite some time. It's a large bill. What are some of the main things that the bill aims to do?
Sure. So the bill essentially does four things. Right now, the mission of the COGCC, the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, in my opinion, is heavily tilted to the oil and gas industry so that they are in the position of never denying a permit whatsoever. We are just trying to right that tilt so that local communities and health, safety, welfare have as much role in their permitting as the interests of oil and gas development. Two, the bill addresses the current fact that there's local control is embodied in our Constitution, the primacy of local control. But there's one major exception where local governments do not have the right of zoning or land use authority. I'm talking about just anything above ground. They do not have a role in the siting of oil and gas by state law. The state law has said, local governments, you're kicked out. We decide everything, so they don't get to weigh in on that. So we are correcting that to give them some role in the siting of oil and gas development in their own communities. Third, we're addressing the issue of forced pooling. Forced pooling is where oil and gas says, I get to take your minerals against your consent. You don't have to agree. I get them. Oil and gas currently is the only industry in or entity in Colorado who actually has the power of eminent domain over a private party other than government. If government wants to widen a road, they have to pay you just compensation. Currently, Oil and gas has the same power to take your property without your consent, but they do not have to pay you just compensation. So we're correcting that. And the fourth thing that we're correcting is the issue of orphan wells. Orphan wells are wells that have been abandoned without being plugged properly.
So just to summarize, it would amend the mandate of the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission from fostering development of oil and gas to regulating it. It would give more power to localities to do some regulating of their own. It would change this practice of forced pooling and basically give residents more say over whether or not oil and gas exploration happens under their property. And it would change the way that orphan or abandoned wells are cleaned up. Those are the four major parts of it.
You did that so much better than me. Thank you, Joshua. But,
you know, that's my job. And it is a big, complex bill that has prompted a lot of really strong opinions on it. And I want to work my way down to Chris and Therese Gilbert and get your thoughts on this. Therese, let me start with you. What are your initial thoughts on this bill?
Well, as I see it, it's bringing the proper role of government back to this process. Having lived in Greeley and seen this go on for the last 8 years, the industry was kind of running ahead. There was a rush to drill ahead of really putting in best management practices. And these practices, if there's no oversight, and you hear on all the ads, we have the tightest regulations. Well, you can have a lot of law in the books, but if you don't have a police force, what does that really mean? So I think, and I'm grateful and happy to see the legislature stepping up, because we have been going to our city council meetings, we've been going to our school boards, and we didn't have any representative have our back. And I think that's been really frustrating. It didn't feel like a democratic process. You had no legal standing if you had questions about drilling going into your neighborhood.
Chris, what are your thoughts on the bill so far?
First, Will, I agree with Therese that using best management practices to minimize impacts on communities, they'll never be zero, but to minimize those impacts is critical. That comes from working closely in a dialogue with communities. And of course, that's what happens. You know, today, not that we couldn't be better, we're always open to ideas to getting better, but if you're an oil and gas producer in Colorado, the majority of your time is dealing with local governments. You have to go through COGCC and meet all those requirements, but the majority of your dialogue, if you're in a town or there's people nearby, is with the neighbors, with the town. It slowed the process down, but I think it's beautiful. It's allowed communities to evaluate trade-offs and the way to do it best. One thing I'll say, the one thing that's different about why there was different regulation for, you know, land use impact for siting Amazon's headquarters or a new Starbucks is they can put that anywhere. The oil and gas was put down 100 million years ago. It is where it is. It can't be moved. And there are owners, the mineral owners, which sometimes are the same as the surface owners and sometimes different, their ability to access their minerals comes from what used to be, or what still is, state preemption, an ability that you got to work and do everything possible with the community. They do have tighter regulations in towns and they do different things, but you've got to let people who own those minerals access to get them out.
Therese, I wonder if you could give me your sense of the moment in which this bill is emerging. It seems like, from the way that some folks have talked about this, that this can't wait, that this is one of those issues that comes at a critical junction for Colorado for an array of different reasons. What's your sense of the timing of this bill?
Well, it's often been said elections have consequences, and we had an election, and the consequence was that the House and the Senate have shifted. But I have real concerns about this bill, actually, and I have a Weld County perspective. And my concern, as much as I believe it is a step, it is a floor, local control issues won't help us in Weld. And I would remind everyone where 90% of the production is coming from, and what is blowing out of Weld will not help your air quality up and down the Front Range. And in Boulder, if you're 20 miles away from the nearest well, in the summer, your child could still have ozone days, be outside breathing air that essentially is like sandpaper to your lungs. So I have real concerns. I'm also a mineral rights owner. Most of Weld Air and Water members were mineral rights owners. We did not have any interest in exploiting our mineral rights, even if one more child gets asthma. And that's how I feel about it. I understand that this is a money issue. I understand in capitalism, that you have every right to make as much money as you can. But the proper role of government is to come in a democracy and balance out all of everyone's individual rights to health, safety, and happiness. And what we don't have is we have not had that balance with fracking, specifically the new kind of fracking with all the chemicals.
And just to be clear for folks who are listening, we are in Weld County. Greeley, Colorado is in Weld County. So, Therese, your concern is that this doesn't go far enough.
No. I think it doesn't go far enough.
Speaker Becker, I wonder how much you empathize with folks who work in the oil and gas industry, who I clearly can hear take a tremendous amount of pride in the work that they do, who don't want to do harm to the environment, who want to care for their families, who found an industry that allows them to do that, and who I get the sense you're just trying to be believed by the state that they really are not trying to destroy the earth in terms of, you know, providing the energy that America needs and feeding their families. I totally understand the environmental imperative there, but I wonder how you see that tension just for working people who are caught in the middle.
Yeah, thank you, Joshua. I absolutely believe people are completely sincere in their desire to have a productive industry and also an industry that is protective of health, safety, welfare, and the environment. I absolutely believe that. I have no interest in trying to destroy the industry or destroy jobs. I don't think this bill will. I think that people have largely attacked the bill based on process, less on substance. I think ultimately this really is about the kind of state that we want. We can have a thriving industry while also being protective of some of the health, safety, and welfare issues that we are seeing arise. So I respect all of you. I absolutely 100% believe that you have the best interests of your families, your business, your state, your community. I still think we can do better.
We're speaking to Casey Becker, the Speaker of the Colorado House, KUNC's Matt Bloom, Therese Gilbert of Weld Air and Water, and Chris Wright of Liberty Oil Field Services. Let me get to some questions from our audience. You wanted to share something about working in the industry. What's on your mind?
Hi, it's Brian. I'm a longtime listener of your show, so I very much thank you for coming here and providing this platform to talk about this. But if I were reliant solely upon the press or activist organizations in this state to get my information about this industry, I wouldn't even know that my job position exists at all. And that is the role of environmental specialist. Before our equipment moves into an area, I make sure that our operations are not going to impact any wildlife or sensitive habit areas like wetlands. Before and after drilling is complete, I make sure that we're adhering to all the state and much more stringent local agreements that we've struck with municipalities about baseline water quality testing. When our pads are constructed, I make sure that we adhere to all best management practices and go above and beyond to ensure that sediment doesn't pollute streams and leave during stormwater events. Once the wells are completed and the site goes into production and the pad is downsized significantly, or old sites are removed as new drilling comes in, the site is reclaimed, and I make sure that that's done properly. If there are any historical releases that we identify, we clean those up. And I'll also add that the vast majority of these spills in this state are historical in nature, but you wouldn't know that from the reporting. They just list number of spills.
With regards to your work, everyone we talked to when we went to visit sites this week was very forthcoming about how proud they were of the increasing effort to reduce the environmental impact. A large part of the complaint we heard tonight was air quality. How much does air quality factor into the work that you do?
Air quality is actually, so I do a lot of surface environmental issues, and air quality is such a big part of what we do that it's an entire separate department within our environmental group.
Brian was one of the many people we heard from at our event with KUNC in Greeley. Just ahead, we'll hear from a 12-year-old with some environmental concerns,
And I may have made a bet with someone about drinking the fluid they use for hydraulic fracturing. Stay close. Let's get back to some edited highlights of our conversation with Colorado State House Speaker K.C. Becker, Chris Wright, the chairman and CEO of Liberty Oilfield Services, Therese Gilbert, the co-founder of Weld Air and Water, and KUNC Energy and Economy reporter Matt Bloom. One of the best things about this event was the wide array of people we heard from, including Allison, a 12-year-old from Fort Collins.
I know that I and the others around my age in this I generation, we are going to be the people who will most likely have to deal with any long-term negative consequences of fracking and these other procedures, like especially stuff like the poisoned water, chemicals released into our air, overdependency on natural gas that could lead to, when we eventually run out, a crisis. I was wondering what us as minors can do, since we do not have the vote right now, like I and all the other people my age and around this generation that care about this issue, what can we do to help prevent some of the lasting negative impacts?
How much does this come up among your classmates? I'm sure 12 and 13-year-olds have a lot of other things to be talking about. But, you know, how much do your classmates talk about oil, gas, pollution compared to everything else that gets discussed in middle school?
We don't talk about it all that much, which is something that I'm kind of disappointed about, seeing as everyone's talking about, like, different national politicians when we're kind of ignoring the issues very close to home. So we don't bring it up much, but I really care about the issue and our environment.
Now, people in the industry, Allison, have said, and I know Chris is about to say, that they're going to great pains. They're doing everything they can to try to make sure that the work that they do is as safe as it can possibly be. Do you believe them?
It depends. I feel like I understand that the oil and gas companies are really making more of an effort than they might have made in the past, but I feel like especially, like, why do they need to drill so close to a playground where there are kids, innocent kids, just trying to enjoy their lives without loud noises and nasty fumes? Like, there should be other places to drill. There must be other places with those resources that are just a little bit farther away. So I feel like they're starting to make an effort, but I feel like we need more.
All right. Allison, thanks very much. Much appreciated. Chris, what would you say to Allison?
Allison, thank you for being here. Obviously a smart, articulate gal. The school is doing well. And what should you do? Well, you're doing it, is engage in that dialogue. Engage, hear people talk, go back and forth, express your opinions, and boy, you express them well. Let me comment on two different things. One, the environment, and the second, health, because those are I think, two huge things. I grew up in Colorado, and when I was your age, I went to campus middle school, and at that time, so this is late 70s, the air in Colorado was dramatically dirtier than it is today. In fact, the very common thing was the brown cloud. I lived 15 miles from the mountains, and probably a third of the days, we could not see the mountains. We had a day like that a couple days ago. It's terrible. We got an air inversion, and, you know, the population has more than doubled since I was a kid. But those are rare, and we really mad when we see them today. They were all the time when I was a kid. So I'm incredibly proud that 40 years later, I'm a lot older than you, you know, the air in Colorado, and there's and it is dramatically cleaner. And I'm actually pretty confident that when you have kids, the air here will be dramatically cleaner yet. That has been the trend. In fact, in London, the air is cleaner now than it's been in over three centuries. So let me talk about the EPA, and you also said, I don't know if I should trust or believe, or Joshua said, do you believe? We shouldn't make opinions based on belief. When you're judging a character, maybe so. But on things like this, I don't want you to believe me. I want you to look at the data and the numbers and see how we're actually doing. The Clean Air Act listed six named pollutants as the six greatest risks to human health. It came out. I was in elementary school when it came out, or junior high, and they've dropped 73% since then. The population of the country's grown massively. We're wealthier. There's way more cars. There's way more people. The earth has gotten simply dramatically cleaner. And the other thing that matters a lot for human health, if you travel, you'll be such an awesome learner. When you go travel to other countries, you'll see how they live, and you almost get to see how our ancestors lived, the people that don't have oil and gas. And they cook within huts. 3 million people die every year just from cooking fuel because they don't have natural gas to cook cleanly on. And it's mostly women and children that die because they're the ones over the stoves cooking. The other thing that matters, the ability to get to hospital, to buy medicines and all that, is sort of wealth. And for low-income people, energy prices matter massively. So back to the comment about OPEC, I went to the Middle East. I was asked, and I went over there a year or so ago to talk about the shale revolution. They're terrified of it. Oil was $100. Now oil is $50. It's the thing I'm the most proud of.
Well, Chris, but let me
the world.
Chris, hold on a second, because I think that Allison was also getting at something else that people her age and millennials have also been concerned about, which is that whatever it is that we do now, they will have to clean up. And one of the other impacts we haven't really discussed is climate change. So even if air quality, even if the particulate, and I hear you totally on particulate matter in the air, you are correct in saying that there are parts of the world that rely much more on coal that have tremendous particulate matter in the air and all kinds of terrible pollution. However, climate change is also an issue, and that is to do with more than just particles in the air. And Allison and her generation are going to have to live with the climate that we leave behind. Is your industry prepared to leave her a better planet than we have right now with regards to climate change?
100%.
How?
And I appreciate that. And they are a distinction.
Allison asked you a direct question. She wants to know how her generation is going to protect its health from the impacts of oil and gas. How?
The continued evolution from cleaner fuels. Wood is the dirtiest of all. We still have over 1 billion people that live burning wood. If we switch them from wood to liquid petroleum gas, which has already happened to 1 billion people, that dramatically reduces both CO2 emissions and pollutants. The largest driver of the U.S. reduction in CO2 emissions, the largest driver is what we do, is shale gas displacing coal from things. It's larger than wind, solar, and energy efficiency combined.
So what the energy industry is doing now is that, it sounds like you're saying, is actually in Allison's best interest in terms of reducing overall pollution.
100%. 100%.
Daniel from Fort Collins, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I just had a question regarding the chemical makeup of the fluids that are used in hydraulic fracturing. And I was just wondering if the exact chemical makeup was public knowledge. And if so, what is that exact chemical makeup?
Good question. Chris?
You bet. So it is public knowledge, and that's another rule that was passed in Colorado in 2011. If I had my way, it would have been way before then. But there's a site called Frac Focus, and you can look up every well and get the complete list of every chemical pumped in that well. We should have done that 20 years ago. We're not great at PR. But I'm very happy that thing is fully public. You know, obviously, dominantly what we pump is water and sand. The next biggest ingredient we pump is a thing called guar, which is what they use to make ice cream. You know, it's a thickening agent. You can buy it at Whole Foods. We pump visine, the equivalent of visine, that takes those guar beans and links them together to make a more viscous fluid. I could go on and on. We use chemicals that are used in reservoirs to clean water to kill microorganisms that go downhole. We use to move water faster with less friction. We use a chemical called polyacrylamide, also known as bowling balls. Those are the biggest by volume chemicals we use. But as I said, everything we pump underground, I can buy at Whole Foods.
Before I let Teresa respond, Chris, are those chemicals safe to leave in the earth?
They are. That's a great question. These are huge. If I was living here and they were drilling wells under my property, I would have all of these. What the hell's going on? What are you doing? Where's it moving? So we have a great thing that Colorado State University, I don't want to badmouth, but shout out another university, has an awesome water monitoring network around Weld County. And in fact, now to get a permit, you've got to monitor groundwater quality before you drill your wells, and then you've got to monitor it afterwards. And having this continuous, but CSU has a large continuous monitoring network so we can see what's in there. But when we pump this stuff underground, so the oil here is about 1.5 miles underground, and there's a ton of natural gas in it. Think the CO2 bubbles that are in your soda can. They've been down there for 100 million years because there's so many impermeable layers that have allowed 100 million years, the bubbles can't even get out. So yes, downhole is incredibly isolated. In fact, it's an idea we used a while ago with Greenpeace's Ascent to dispose of drill cuttings, like basically an oil field waste. The safest place to put it, things, is 1.5 miles underground. Landfills work, but it's less than 1/4 inch of plastic. They work, but when you inject something underground, it is virtually impossible for it to migrate to groundwater.
Go ahead, Teresa.
Well, just a brief comment. You would like this. Sometimes I think the industry would like me when I explain this to people. There's a big difference between frac fluid and flowback. You can drink the frac fluid. You shouldn't. It's probably not a good idea, but you could. So frac fluid is the chemicals they put in the proppants and the slickens in with the little tiny particles of sand that keep the fissures open. So it'd be similar, let's say you go to get pizza and you're drinking suicides and you get sick and, you know, probably wasn't a good idea to drink all those chemicals, but then you throw up. Now, you're not going to be able to re-ingest your throw-up. That's a good way of thinking of it. That is the flowback. That should not end up anywhere.
Would you drink it, Chris?
Now, which one are we talking about?
This fluid you said that was safe to drink. Would you drink it?
Sure. I mean, it wouldn't taste good. I wouldn't have it as a regular drink, but would I drink it? Sure.
$100? Shake on it?
Oh, sure. 100%.
Post a video to Twitter in the next 7 days. Otherwise, you're making a $100 donation to my station.
You got it, Joshua.
Matt Bloom, I wonder if you could just, for folks who are listening to this debate for the very first time, this is clearly something that inspires a lot of passion. But this is kind of an existential crisis for Colorado right now. Like this is kind of a fight for what Colorado is going to be in the future. This isn't just about oil companies or, you know, even air quality. This feels like it's bigger than even that.
The population of where we're sitting right now, the area we're sitting in right now, is expected to double by 2050. And this problem is extremely personal to folk. This is a topic and an issue just from covering it and hearing from folks. It is one of the most personal issues that I've covered as a reporter for folks, and for a good reason. It's ingrained in our daily lives here.
One last word for everyone else on the panel, Madam Speaker, Chris and Therese. There's been a great deal of divergent opinion about what oil and gas mean for Colorado and what its future should be. Anything we agree on in terms of what the energy future of Colorado should look like? Are there any points where the three of you are on the same page today with regards to this issue?
I bet Speaker? I can find something. I think a lot is changing in the energy sector in this state, across the nation, and across the world. There's very few things in Colorado that have more support than a transition to renewable energy, because people see it as a low-cost fuel that doesn't have an ongoing cost, just maintenance of wind turbines, transmission lines, et cetera. I think it's something Colorado has to prepare for. I don't think oil and gas is going to be pushed out anytime soon. And I also think it's actually, as Chris was mentioning earlier, natural gas that has actually led to a decrease in coal and a transition to renewable energy. I think that this conversation we're having right now is just a part of this larger conversation of how energy is changing statewide and nationally. I think both of us have, and all of us have, respect for the people who work in the industry and who have this as a lifeline. And I think at the state, we're going to continue to think about how our economy, how our energy sector is transitioning. So if you want to be a part of that conversation, I am open to it. This is one piece of the puzzle that people are saying, we're at an inflection point. We have to do this better. I think we can. And I do think that oil and gas as a productive part of our economy and a more thoughtful approach to development in communities are compatible and will be compatible. And I think what we're doing is not going to be devastating for the industry.
Chris Wright, where do we agree today?
I would think we all agree that we want more energy available for people, affordable energy, and clean energy. I would suspect we all want that on this panel. My only plea is that when we do changes and things, we got to think about low-income people. The people that come to debates and are in senates and in universities and all that, they're not the makeup of the majority of the population. But clean, affordable energy and more opportunity for people born less lucky than the three of us, I think we all agree on that.
And Therese, last word, where do we all agree right now, if anywhere?
I do agree with Chris that we have to have clean energy. I believe that this fracking process is brilliant. You went to MIT, you're the smartest one up here. I have a real belief in that engineering will get us better solutions. But in the meantime, I want to remind everyone, a clean environment just is a safe home. People want their environment to be clean. And we can do better, and we have to do better. And I don't think we have to have people lose their jobs to do it. So go back in geothermal and get after that.
That was Therese Gilbert, a middle school teacher and co-founder of Weld Air and Water, Colorado State House Speaker K.C. Becker, Chris Wright, the chairman and CEO of Liberty Oilfield Services, and KUNC's energy and economy reporter Matt Bloom. And by the way, remember that bet about Chris drinking fracking fluid? Well, he did it. And we shared the video on our Twitter feed. We're at 1A. This show was produced by Amanda Williams, with special thanks to Matt Bloom and KUNC, and to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, whose grant funds this project. To watch the full unedited event, go to the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.